Get ready, folks, because here it comes. Intention. Now, what we're talking about here may not be all that new. It may be something that those of faith, those of religious persuasion, have always known. They know prayer works. I think we all know, well, not all of us, but I think most people know that prayer works. Now, I've got a very sensitive question for Lynn McTaggart when we come back, and that is, what are the studies, and that's what she's looked at, say about religiously based prayer for a person's well-being or health or whatever you might pray for versus raw, non-religious intention, raw, focused, non-religious intention? We will ask in a moment. Those of faith out there will say, duh, of course it works. Where have you been, Art? So, Lynn, is there a measurable difference between people who pray in the name of God or Jesus for a person's health and well-being versus those who use raw intent?
No, to be honest. And this is not to denigrate religion or to try to say that that, you know, one works better than the other, or to say that there is no such thing as religion. But certainly from a scientific point of view, the studies show that, you know, any kind of intention can work just as well as another. And many times what intenders of all sorts say, and they all said some common things, one aspect of it was a kind of a sense of surrender. You know, I always thought that intention was this kind of real effort, you know, that this real focused thought, like, you know, when I'm watching my girls playing a sports competition or something like that, I'm sitting there and I'm a real noisy mom and I'm, you know, I'm going, you know, I'm right in there catching the ball with them.
Sure.
But they all describe something very different. They describe a kind of a surrender. You put your intention out there and then you surrender to a greater force. Now, that greater force could be the field. It could be Jesus. It could be whatever you think. It could be one of a number of beliefs. But the point is, there is, whatever you want to call it, it's a greater sort of energy force. And so that's why I'm saying it's more or less the same. But certainly the studies of Qigong masters, of Buddhist monks, of prayer, of certain prayer, all seem to have a similar effect.
Okay. So it's a real power. I don't doubt that for a second. But it may turn out to be a power given to us by a creator. There's no way to say that is not true. But in measurements, raw intent is as powerful as prayer in the name of Jesus or God.
Well, remember, too, there have been a lot of prayer studies that have shown that, you know, prayer doesn't work. I mean, these studies have been, I mentioned earlier on in the program, there's some real big problems with this. There was a great big study called STEP, done by Herbert Benson from Harvard. And in this study, they had a group of heart patients, and they had prayer, you know, their prayers were from three different kinds of groups. I think it was the Unity Church, a few other types. And they were only given the name and the last initial of the person to be prayed for. And so many people who say, you know, who believe in prayer say, and use prayer, say, well, this isn't the way prayer is used in real life. It would be impossible for their groups to establish any kind of meaningful connection or even to zero in on the people they're praying for. And it's sort of a bit like trying to make a cell phone call to somebody and expecting them to try to answer when you've only dialed the first three digits of the phone number. So, you know, you're not hooking into the person. And they were, you know, they showed that that a lot of the none of those studies used any kind of criteria to pick the people who in the prayer groups, or to, you know, keep track of how long they even prayed. You know, how long is a prayer? How do you study it? So one of the big problems in looking at science, the science of prayer, is it's very difficult to try to control that in a scientific way. I think the better studies are just the plain ecumenical healing studies, where you're able to look at it in a certain way and quantify it scientifically. But one thing they did find in one study of healers is that it worked better if the recipient knew the healer. It also worked well, it worked better if both of them believed something similar. They had similar beliefs. And thirdly, it worked, and this is the thing I found most interesting, is it worked best when the healer was in good health. It worked when the healer was in a good mood, when the healer was feeling well in every way. So in a sense, you know, you heal the healer first, and then it works the best.
Isn't that interesting? All right. There's another thing about the quantum world. It really doesn't respect time necessarily. So in the book, you, I guess, offer some evidence that people can pray for yesterday. In other words, go back and change the past. Is there actually evidence for this?
This was the most mind-boggling part of the research, Art. I was amazed by this one study. It was a prayer study, and it was done in Israel with a bunch of patients who have had blood infection, sepsis. And they were carefully divided into two groups, and these were all patients in the hospital. And one half of the, you know, one group was prayed for to see if they could get better more quickly, and the other half wasn't. And the people who were prayed for were better in every way. They got they got better quicker than the other ones. And the only catch of it was the people who were prayed for had been in the hospital in the early 90s, and the prayers were carried out in the year 2000. And now the guy who did this actually wanted to prove that alternative medicine doesn't work. He was a skeptic.
Oh, no kidding.
No, this was supposed to show this stuff doesn't work. And I think he meant to say you can't use the scientific model to look at this. But he published it in The Lancet, and it got pounced on by skeptics and believers alike to show that, you know, you can... that A, prayer studies work, and B, you can go back and change the past. So this became a real argument. But, you know, I started looking at this because this is where I have a big bunch of trouble. You know, how can you go back and change the past? And there have been enormous numbers of studies trying to do just this thing, where they've tried to change the activity in a shopping mall, you know, the way people walk in a shopping mall, whether or not you could influence that retroactively. This is called retroactive intention. There have been some really interesting studies. We talked about REG machines. There were some great studies done by a guy called Helmut Schmidt, where he, instead of putting the REGs on a computer screen, he had them as a series of left and right clicks. So they were an audio kind of equipment. And he would tape it already, so he would have the output already. Then he'd have somebody listen to it 4 to 6 days later and attempt to change it. And now remember, the thing had already been run. But when he went and he put a master in a vault, so he'd have that master. He'd go back and listen to it and hear that there, if he had asked the person to do more left ear clicks than right ear clicks, he'd find that it had been changed in that direction.
God. Oh, that's incredible.
So you think, well, what was going on here? And what was going on was not that he changed the past. What was going on was that the mind reached back, in a sense, down the timeline and affected it at the point when it was generated. So in other words, we don't change the past.
Well, but that is affecting the past, though.
Our future goes back and fixes the present, changes the present.
Changes the present.
Yeah. That's what a lot of people are talking about. A lot of scientists have now evidence to show, in a sense, the past, our past and our present are shaking hands with each other all the time. The future is constantly affecting, future conditions are constantly affecting the present.
This is such exciting research, Lynn. Where do we go from here with it? Where does the research go?
Well, this is what happened to me, as I say. I kind of came up against a brick wall at a certain point of my research. The thing that I was really interested in was what happens when lots of minds think the same thing at the same time. You know, where's the evidence for that? How much, you know, does it get stronger? Does intention get stronger if you've got more than one person thinking the same thing at the same time? And there was some tantalizing evidence about this, but not really, not enough, you know. And so my husband kind of turned to me and said, well, why don't you do these experiments yourself? And, you know, I had to laugh at this because, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm a science writer. But the last experiments I carried out was in my 10th grade science class, you know, dissecting frogs. So I thought, well, I can't do this. But then I started to think, well, wait a second. I've got hundreds of thousands of readers. I've got an experimental body here that's bigger than anybody, you know, any other lab. Suppose I talk to some of the scientists I know and see if we can set up a global laboratory. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we're doing. So in a sense, the book is really just a prelude to what we want to find out about intention. So in other words, we're setting up labs in Germany, in University of Arizona, with the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And we're going to have periodic studies of intention where all the readers have to send their intentions all at the same time. To some sort of measurable target. So this will start telling us more and more and more about it. Because
what are you going to try to do?
Pardon me?
What are you going to try to do? You're going to get many minds to focus, right?
Yeah, we're going to tell them to, let's say our first target is going to be, we're creating a little mini Gaia, you know, like a little mini world. And we want to artificially raise the temperature. And we're going to ask all of our readers at that point, and I think I think we've got our first one targeted for March 24th. And we're going to have people all send their intention at the same time, a very specific intention that I'm going to have on our website that basically says, you know, we're going to try to lower this temperature by a certain number of degrees. And we'll see. We're going to have the scientists on board. We'll have our webcam. And we're going to see, you know, whether or not we can do that. We've got a lot of plans for a number of, they're all philanthropic targets. We're not trying to win the lottery here. We're not trying to make anybody $1 million or whatever. We're just trying to see, you know, what can we do with our thoughts? Can they be a big force for good?
Yes, they can. They can be a big force. I'm not sure that's the part that got me. You know, we created rain, Lynn. You know about my experiments,
oh,
right?
Oh, I do.
What worries me is, will it always be as you intend? In other words, if I enjoin millions of people to try and create rain over a specific area that's been in drought and there's no rain in the forecast, and it happens, for example, in Texas, Lynn, we created rain in an area that had been just drought-ridden. And they got so damn much rain, it flooded. It was awful. Now,
Yes. That's
when I began to think, hey, I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't understand the dynamics of what I'm doing. And so how do we get a grasp on this so it can be used safely?
Well, this is why we want to keep it in very strict laboratory conditions. This is why we're just trying it as an experiment first, because we don't understand. We have to learn more. And so what I felt I could do was just harness this as an experiment first and begin to learn. And we find it, if we keep it in one little safe laboratory place, then we can learn. First, we'll start with non-human targets, because again, as you say, we don't know. We'll find out, what do we have a positive effect? Do we have a negative effect on this little mini Gaia? We have other plans. If we do go onto humans, we might just try something like attention deficit. That's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you can easily measure somebody's attention or lack of attention. So we might take one child and try to send an intention to see if we can just increase her attention for that time. But we'll be very careful about it. We may not go onto human targets right away. We've been thinking about trying to do, we could even track this on a computer screen if we have a patient with Alzheimer's. Let's say we just try to get that patient who's in a hospital, just to help that patient who may be very confused, to just go back to his room. We could track it right on the computer screen to see whether or not we're doing it. But we'd be very careful and selective about our targets so that we can't harm anything or anybody. And we just learn, because this is what needs to be done. We need to push the boat out here and really learn about it. This is where science always goes. You need to ask an outrageous question like, what if our thoughts could change the world? And find out what happens. And that's the point. That's what science has always done. It's always pushed forward by asking a ridiculous question like, you know, what if stones fall from the sky? Or can you take a giant cylinder of steel and let it fly through the air?
All right, well, here's one for you. When I do this program, Coast to Coast AM, I always open up by reading sort of a summary of the world news. The world news, Lynn, is never good. If you take a five-minute summary of UPI or AP or any of the major news services, it's absolutely concentrating on the negative. People dead under a collapsed building. How many American soldiers have been killed in Iraq? I could go on and on and on, but that's the news. Now, I wonder if we can both agree that if what we're talking about with regard to intent is true, the constant battering that the American people get of bad news has got to have an effect on the world.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. I oftentimes say, do not read the news, because it becomes your life's intention.
Yes.
You know, the thoughts that we are kicking around all the time, those silly little, that little stream of consciousness we have all the time becomes our life's intention.
Hear, hear.
I believe the thoughts that are going on in your mind, you know, I wondered about this once, about, you know, just unintended thoughts. I had a cleaner. I re-renovated my house. And I had a cleaner who accidentally put too much limescale remover on and stripped off all of the chrome on all of the taps in my house. And I had just renovated it. I freaked out so much. I had to go to bed. I was so upset about this. And I found out later that the point that I sort of vented my fury, she'd fallen off the bus and broken her leg.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, you have to wonder, does that unintended thought of mine, did that have any effect on her? And I had a similar thing with my bank manager, who, you know, when a computer program, because everything's by computer, didn't pick up a deposit and so bounced some of my checks. I was so furious about this. And I found that my bank manager the next day fell down and broke all of her front teeth.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, was that me? Did I do that? And of course, you know, this is what I want to learn and find out. Do these unintended thoughts we have streaming through our minds, do they become our life's intention? Do they affect other people? I think they do.
That's an awfully important question, Lynn. All right, hold tight. We're at a break point. But folks, it's true. Read any five-minute summary of world news. Now, that's laying a groundwork for millions of minds to imagine that everything's falling apart, perhaps causing it to. I'm Art Bell. Indeed, from the high desert. Stephen in Bakersfield, California, fast blast me, Art. Good news is boring. Bad news sells. Therefore, that's all we see. Good news is out there. It's just not interesting. Simple as that. Well, true. Absolutely true. And but you know what? I'm beginning to get to the point in my life where I'm willing to entertain all kinds of notions that I previously would not entertain. For example, and I'll even go this far, as you know, I'm watching the climate very closely. I'm a big believer in global warming. I read you all kinds of stories about the latest studies and the temperatures rising and the North Pole melting and all the rest of this horrible stuff that's going on. How am I to know, honestly, that the news that I'm giving you is not causing a sort of reaction in millions of minds out there that's causing the problem to worsen? How am I to know that when I read you stories about more Americans than ever dying in Iraq, that that doesn't cause more Americans to die in Iraq? It's a rough thought to have, but I'm willing to entertain it because all of what Lynn Taggart is talking about, all of this intention stuff appears to be absolutely true. So then you have to begin to entertain some of these notions about the way we're conducting ourselves in the world. We'll be right back. Or for example, Lynn, all of these really good police shows like CSI and all the rest of them, they tend to concentrate on plots and stories about serial killers with weird sexual proclivities that chop women up into little pieces and all kinds of horrible things that actually are fairly rare. But how do we know? How do we know? In fact, we might even suspect that putting this into the minds of so many millions of people actually is a causative thing. You see where I'm going, right?
I think you're right. I mean, this is what I was looking at all the time with the material that I've been looking at with the intention experiment. It seems that, as I say, that flitting, that material that flits through our minds, the flotsam and jetsam of our daily lives, seems to have an impact all the time. Every thought, if you think every thought is the thing that's affecting other things, that we are sending and receiving all the time, the information we're receiving is affecting our bodies. Our thoughts are affecting our bodies all the time. And that we're taking this in. I mean, one thing that I was fascinated about talking about bodies is the idea that that the brain can't distinguish between a thought and a physical action. One thing I looked at that was very interesting about intention, I wanted to see how intention worked in real life, and I started looking at sports people because that's where they use mental rehearsal all the time. They use thoughts all the time. The greatest proponent of this was Muhammad Ali. When you actually study him, you see this guy was a master of intention. He used every possible intention, including the greatest line of all time, "I am the greatest." You know, that's the best intention you can use. When you look at his little rhyming quatrains, they were all little intentions in disguise. You know, Archie Moore's going to hit the floor on four. You know, and he actually would do that. He would set that intention, and it would come to pass. Anyway, my point is, I started studying what these sports people do. And as I say, they all engage in mental rehearsal because they realize the brain can't distinguish between a thought and a physical action. Perfect example of that is study of people. They divided people, into two groups, and one group went out and worked in the gym, and the other group just thought about their biceps getting bigger, and they found that the people who worked out in the gym had an increase in their measurements of their arms by 30%, and the guys who just thought about it, it was an increase of 15%. So it was half as good. So for any of the couch potatoes out there, all you have to do is think yourself into the burn. You don't have to actually do it.
This is all so incredible. So, again, when you look at our news, whether it's the ABC, CBS, NBC nightly news, or me reading a world summary, if the if the conclusion at the end of that newscast is, boy, the world is really going to hell in a handbasket, if that's what you believe to be true, and you spend some time thinking about that, aren't you helping it along?
Well, yeah, I think you are. I think with everybody who thinks and notices, I think with every time the mind notices, it is sending an intention. With what we understand now about the science, about the fact that things out there are affected by us at every moment. We're sending and receiving all the time. That what we are thinking, we're sending. What we're sending, we're contributing to. So, and we're also, as I say, we're taking this into our bodies. This has become something that's affecting that dynamism that is our organism that is changing all the time. And if your thoughts are, you know, if your thoughts are negative all the time, mm-hmm. it becomes your life's intention.
Okay. And how can we experimentally, Lynn, determine whether one person's concentrated intention is as strong as a million concentrated intentions?
Well, as I say, that's the point of our study with the intention experiment, is just to really test this in a laboratory condition with our readers. And what I'm going to test it very carefully by, I'm making sure that people have to go through certain procedures on our website. Incidentally, Art, I just wanted to mention we've got your link to my website is Living the Field. Our other website, we've also got one which is theintentionexperiment.com, which has the whole thing there. And we're going to have, as I say, webcam. We're going to let people send their intentions at certain points. We're going to give them certain tests, you know, little psychological tests, so we know who's doing it. And we're going to test what's stronger. Is it just 10,000 people? Is 10,000 people stronger than 5,000 people? What about when it's 100,000 people? Is that stronger still? There were some interesting, we carried out one intention experiment that I recount in my book, where we had 16 meditators in London, where I live, and we sent an intention to four targets in Germany. We sent, it was two kinds of algae. You know, scientists like things like algae, a jade plant, and a human being.
Okay.
And we stressed all four of them. You know, we made the woman drink three cups of coffee. We put a pin through the jade plant, and we poured some vinegar into the algae medium so that they would all be stressed. And the reason we did that is when you're stressed, you send out more of these little light. You know, when I said that everything sends out light, they're
yes.
called in science biophoton emissions. And when things are stressed, they send out too much light. And so our intention was to actually lower this light slightly. And to the amazement of the physicists who were doing this, we had an effect on all four targets. So the question is now, okay, so what if there were 15 of us? Are we going to have a bigger effect if we've got 100,000 of us? You know, this is what we're going to test out. There seems to be some very, very, you know, interesting evidence. You probably have talked about that transcendental meditations, those studies on your show where, you know, when you meditate, a certain percentage of meditators in any city meditate, the crime rate seems to go down.
Right.
But that's people without sending a real intention. You know, they're just meditating. So what happens if we actually send the intention? That's what we want to find out.
You said you were going to create a little world. What actually is it?
It'd be like a terrarium in a sense. And we'll create it with, you know, we'll create a great big terrarium with different plants there and maybe even little living things. But mainly we'll just have the plants, something that we can measure. And we'll have to have two of them. We're going to have a control one. And because, you know, with any good scientific study, you've got a control. And you've got the experimental one. And so we're going to have all of our readers at the appointed time all over the world. And we're going to have, you know, we're going to have clocks on our website so everybody knows what the right time is. It's 5 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, which is, I guess, for that would be 9 o'clock in the morning in West Coast, U.S. and
right.
I think it's noontime on the East Coast. Everybody's going to send their intention all at the same time, and we'll let everybody know exactly the right words to think, because specificity is really important with intention.
How?
And
how
we'll
are you
measure
going to...
it then, and we'll just measure to see what happens.
How are you going to differentiate between the control and the target?
With it, control will be somewhere hidden away where people won't be able to see it, and the target will be on our website, so people will be able to see it.
Oh, so they'll actually, it'll be video, and they can go
it'll
to the website.
It'll be on a webcam,
okay.
Yeah. You'll be able to see it. And we'll do that all the time. I mean, if we have a child we're going to send an intention to, you'll see the picture of that child on it. We'll put it on real time on the webcam. So we'll actually see it. And there was one study I wanted to try to do that was really interesting that got carried out in Gary Schwartz's lab at University of Arizona. They had some healers. They took two leaves off the same plant, and they measured them so that they were identical in every way, even their biophoton emissions. And they then clipped the leaves. They stuck them in two pots of plant, pots of dirt. And, of course, this is a cut leaf, so it's going to die soon. And they found that the leaf, they had the control leaf, died in about 2 days. And they had healers send an healing intention to the other leaf, and the other leaf lived for 10 days.
Wow.
So that'd be interesting to try. One of the things like that, because we can actually see it, we'll show people the dead leaf, or the life leaf, and just see how long we can keep this leaf alive. So those are some of the questions we're going to start asking.
Let's suppose for a second, Lynn, that you find all of this is real, which is my expectation that you will, that you'll verify everything you try. Then what?
Then we start figuring out, okay, how do we use this? Because this is powerful. As I say, there's plenty of evidence about negative intention. Some interesting evidence about whether or not to block it. So we have to ask, how do you use this as a force for good? This is why we're trying to do careful philanthropic targets. Mm-hmm. But let's say we find that with our little mini Gaia that it works. Then okay, then maybe the next stage is to try a little place. But again, you've got to carefully control this. We could unleash a bomb here, So we have to be very careful about this. But I think our intention here is really to learn, all of us to learn, and then to say, okay, how do we use this in our lives? If this is our new paradigm, if we realize that we are all connected and that we all have an effect all the time on each other, how can we have the best effect? How do we bring this into our lives? How do we have to suddenly start thinking, well, actually, everything I'm thinking is affecting everybody around me. Imagine the thoughts swimming through your heads about your kids. He's such a slob, or he's, pathetic at math. That
yes.
becomes that kid's intention. That becomes that child.
That's so what I'm beginning to believe, yes.
Yeah, so you have to start monitoring yourself a bit more and saying, okay, well, I got to be careful. On the positive side, maybe you as a community can start using your intentions, getting together and start using some positive intentions. And instead of letting all this negative stuff wash all over you all the time that you read in the newspapers, maybe mm-hmm. you can all just send some positive intentions to clean up your community, to lower your crime rate. So we're going to ask that, too. We may try intentions to lower crime rate in some particular area. That would be a good one, too. So do what TM did, the TM people did, but actually send out an intention.
Mm-hmm. How careful were those crime rate studies, and how effective were they?
Okay. There have been some questions about them. I mean, remember, they were all published in peer-reviewed journals. That meant some group of people had to study these, and they would have thrown them out if they were bad. So I think that they were reasonably good studies. There continue to be questions about the TM organization. because of, you know, the cost of it, et cetera, et cetera. But I think they try to do, I think they're sincere in their belief and they're sincere in their attempt to quantify what's going on with meditation. So I think they certainly are an interesting marker. And then,
well, I guess what I'm asking is, what were the published results? It seems like I remember something about Washington, D.C. or some city.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were studies. They showed that when you had, they looked at 48 cities around America, and they found as long as there was a certain percentage of the population meditating, that the crime rate would go down. They did other studies looking at the misery index, you know, that unemployment and things like that. And they found, again, with a certain percentage of meditators, the misery index went down. They also had advanced meditators actually send an intention to hot spots like Israel. And they found that at certain points when they were sending intentions with their meditation, that conflict dropped as well. So there's been enormous numbers of studies done by the TM group about this. But as I say, in the main, they were looking at just what happens when a certain percentage of the population is meditating regularly. These were people who were just meditating. They weren't sending a deliberate intention to change something.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is to take it one step further and say, okay, what goes on if we really send a deliberate intention to something, and we're all thinking the same thought at the same time. Now, I mean, there have been some studies like that. They were the studies where they had random event generators going on all the time, like the Global Consciousness Project,
mm-hmm.
Where they were trying to measure when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time, does it have an effect on these random machines? And they found, they did a whole bunch of studies on this, showing that like when the O.J. Simpson trial, when every mm-hmm. American was on the edge of his or her seat waiting to find out was O.J. guilty or innocent in his murder trial, at just that point, they found there was an enormous shift on the REG machines running. Or they had them running around the world. They had similar things when the Princess of Wales was killed. There was a big shift.
And of course 9/11.
9/11, the biggest shift of all. So lots of people thinking the same thought, but not making an intention to change. And so my intention experiment is really to start looking at, you know, intention to change and what we can do with it.
All right. Well, what blew me away about the 9/11 measurements at Princeton were that it occurred about 30 minutes before the actual event, and I've been running that through my head I guess we all know the quantum world defies time as we understand it. How does that settle out with you, the fact that this great spike occurred just before, time-wise, 30 minutes before the actual event?
There's a lot of evidence, Art, that we have an anticipatory effect here. When we're picking up news and bad news, we mm-hmm. pick it up early. And they found that with a lot of studies, it's like you hear this signal early. There's no question that there's good evidence for precognition, is what they call it.
Right.
And certainly people were picking this up all over the place. I'm sure you heard about Rupert Sheldrake, who did a study, British biologist, who did a questionnaire asking anyone to write him in who'd had a dream about 9/11 before it happened. And there were hundreds of people with unbelievably specific dreams about plane crashes into high-rise buildings the night before. And there were lots of things like that. Like a lot of people, there have been some studies showing that when there's a train crash, the numbers are down oftentimes because mm-hmm. a lot of people have just had a bad feeling about that train and they've canceled their trip. Even
exactly.
The same thing happened with the Titanic. The numbers were actually down because of that.
And all right, Lynn, hold on. We're pressed by the clock here. We're going to open the phone lines when we come back. Judging from the number ringing before we even open them, you have a lot of questions. So, Lynn McTaggart and you next.